Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss random episodes of Star Trek with non-random guests. I am joined once again by the person in my life whom I may have spoken about Star Trek the most, Mr. Jason Snell.
I think that's right. Hi, Scott. We're going to watch a non-new episode of Star Trek. Where we do that on the Vulcan Hello podcast. We watch the new Star Trek. This is not new by any stretch of the imagination.
No. This is old Star Trek.
Old Star Trek.
Not the oldest Star Trek you can get, but close. It is season 3, episode 11, or episode 7 on Amazon Prime. It was listed as episode 7. I don't know why. Of the original series, Day of the Dove.
Day of the Dove, yes. Season 3. Scott, you gave me a season 3 episode and I was like, I was worried. I think this is one of the better season 3 episodes, so thank you for that.
Doesn't speak highly of season 3, but yes, it is true. I have some thoughts about this episode, but before we delve into that, people who are listening already know who you are. So I'm going to ask you a question that I have not prepared you for.
Okay, great.
That's the way of Random Trek. Who's your favorite Klingon, Jason?
Who's my favorite Klingon? Wow.
There are many good choices out there.
You got
Kang, who's on this episode.
Sure. You've got,
who was going to be Kor, which is why at the beginning they seem to know, Kirk and Kang seem to know each other because it was supposed to be Kor.
Yeah, but look, they have other adventures that we don't see.
In the same circles.
Could be Koloth. The big three, Kang, Kor, and Koloth. But you know, and then there's, of course, we love Worf.
We do love Worf. I don't remember Worf, Michael Dorn's character in Star Trek VI, where I assume is also
Colonel Worf. I believe.
He has a Worf. He's a lawyer.
Worf. My favorite Klingon, I have decided, is Kalar.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, Worf's girlfriend who dies, and it's sad. Alexander's
sad.
Mom.
There's blood yell.
I love that episode that she's on. She's great because she shows up and she's tough and sassy and she gives Worf everything he can handle and more, and she's in charge, and it's Susie Plaxton, who's great, who was in played a couple different characters in Star Trek, and she was in like a sitcom, and she was a very likable, fun actress, and I thought that was a great part. So that's, I know it's a little kind of out there, but that's my choice. Also, is it Gowron that's got the big eyes? He's pretty fun.
That is Gowron.
He's pretty fun, but I'm going to go with Kalar. But Gowron is also hilarious and strange and pretty good.
I do love Gowron. There are many fine Klingons to choose from. I will answer my own question with the Duras sisters.
Yes. Lursa and Bator.
Very good Klingons. They show up. They make all kinds of mischief. They meet their end.
They do.
I won't spoil where, in case people haven't listened or watched those episodes or movies. I'm not going to say which. Close second, or I guess close third, because I got a twofer in my pick. General Kang? Chang?
General Chang. General Chang.
Chang,
yes.
From Star Trek.
Christopher Plummer. Oh, he's a good one.
Oh, man.
He's a good one.
And, chewing on the scenery.
And actually, Chancellor Gorkon is great. David Gorkon Warner as our you know, our friendly Gorbachev Klingon. Yeah,
many fine Klingons in Star Trek VI.
So many to choose from.
You can't go wrong with the Klingons. What is it going to take me to get you in a Klingon today? Well, there are some bad Klingons, and in this episode, Day of the Dove, I don't know if they're. So here's my question to you, Jason.
Okay. All right,
because I have two major issues with this episode, and then otherwise I think it's fine. Why does nobody see this energy being obviously lurking around?
Right.
In many scenes? That's my major issue with it. And then I don't understand at the very beginning. Like, I don't know when the energy being starts to influence them, because at the very beginning, they don't seem to be acting like themselves, the characters we know and love. Am I to assume that from even before this episode has started, the energy being has manipulating them directly? Because I know it's lured them both to this planet, both the ship, the Klingon ship, and the Enterprise. But they just feel like they're off.
Yeah,
immediately.
It is. Well, they're looking for a colony. But
destroyed
they find
colony.
No trace of it at all. So it perhaps was not even really there, and that it was a fake distress call sent by the entity in order to lure them there. And then obviously it lures the Klingons there too, and breaks their ship, right? Like blows up their ship, which is also kind of weird, but it really is just trying to, clearly, whether we're talking about the writer of the episode or we're talking about the entity, it's trying to build this scenario where it can lock humans and Klingons in perfect balance, grappling with each other throughout eternity in a real kind of like, I have no mouth and I'm a scream kind of scenario, which is the heart of where this thing is going.
Yes, and I like that. I like the main idea behind this episode of let's lock these people into battle so that I can feed off of their aggression. But it is so weird. They beam down. There's no evidence that a colony has ever been there.
Yeah.
And Captain Kirk decides that means that there is some new Klingon weapon that completely destroys all trace of any colony. And also, colonists apparently only come in 100 packs because the Federation colony had 100 people on it. The Klingon colony that was supposed to be there also, or no, the colony where Chekhov's pretend brother lived also had 100 people in it. So
that's right. It's 100 at a time, filling the universe, 100 people at a time, I guess. Yeah. As a kid watching this, it was just, you know, you're getting, and I think this was the intent, is like, let's get to it. Let's get to it. We want by the end of the teaser, we want Klingons punching Captain Kirk and like, we're going to take your ship and then see this weird light pattern in the background going, yes, yes, fight. Yes. And which is so, yes, as an adult, I look at it and I think structurally, this is very weird, especially since the story progresses in fits and starts and doubles back on itself a bunch, and there's a lot of it's slow and kind of repetitious, and I don't know what happened. Look, season 3 of Star Trek, there's so many problems with it, but it feels like, I don't know, if I'm giving feedback in the script process, what I would probably say is I'd actually like a stronger beginning where we actually see this unfolding, see this being singling them out in some way and slowly kind of like amping up the paranoia. And instead, you're right, it's sort of already happened. You know, it sent a fake signal, I guess. It's blown up the Klingon ship for the most part. Like it all happens sort of like so quickly. And I'd understand that if they were rushing to sort of like the other 5 acts of the episode, but it really isn't much there afterward. There's plenty of room. So yeah, the teaser jumps over a lot to get to the rest of the episode. And they didn't need to.
I think this episode would be better if they did exactly what you suggested and made the teaser the Enterprise getting the distress signal. Like Spock saying, there's no record of a colony there. And Captain Kirk being like, we must go rescue them from the Klingon animals or whatever.
Right. Yeah. The teaser might even say, instead of an unknown ship, it might even say, oh, it's the Klingons. Arg. And then, and then they'll be like, oh, this is war. We have to go. And then then we all are fooled. Cause it's not like they hold back the alien's in the teaser anyway, but you might want to hold it back just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And make it a little more mysterious about what's going on. In fact, I was thinking showing it flitting around is an interesting choice, right? Because they could make it that we don't at first understand what's going on. And then there's a moment where they maybe do a scan and discover that there's something wrong. Or maybe there's a reveal where it's like, there's a glowy thing. This is that's what's behind all this, the glowy thing. But instead, like, there's no attempt made to do any of that.
They beam down and we see the glowy thing. And clearly the people who have beamed down to the planet should see the glowy thing, but they do not.
I always just accepted that it's messing with their minds. And so maybe part of it is that they can't see it, or it's really just for us to see that it's there. And it stays out of their eye line because it wants to be, you know, it's just there to kind of watch them and feed on them. But yeah, it's weird and kind of inconsistent. I agree.
And I could buy that, except much, much, much later in the episode, Spock finally scans the Enterprise for life forms.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, the computer says that there's an additional life form on the Enterprise.
Right. And again, that revelation should probably come be more exciting and maybe even be the reveal, like in what is it in Court Martial, right, where there's that reveal that there's an extra heartbeat. There could have been a reveal like why does everything seem off, and that's not what this episode does. Speaking of scanning, by the way, I don't know if you noticed this. In the very first scene in the teaser, they beam down and they're walking like through the planet set. And Captain Kirk says to Chekhov, basically, scan Mr. Chekhov, or status report Chekhov. And Chekhov, gets his tricorder and opens it up and starts reading things out. And I thought, that's interesting, if you think about it, like, what's wrong with Chekhov? That, like, Kirk is basically saying, Chekhov, you should be scanning now. And the way it's played, it's like he hurried, opens it up and starts reading out things. And I thought that was just a weird, maybe directorial choice in the moment. Cause like, I don't know. It struck me as being kind of funny that normally you'd see them beam down and then Chekhov would take out his tricorder and start reading. But instead he's just looking around. Maybe that was just a Chekhov thing. They're like, oh, he's wide eyed. He has to be.
He's an ensign
to do everything. I don't know. But I thought it was a weird choice in a weird scene.
Yes, a very weird scene.
Yeah, because it's just there to get the Klingons to show up and punch.
Exactly, which they do very quickly, and they show up and this is, I will give Commander Kang kudos for being very sure of himself, because he beams down and he says, Kirk, you've destroyed my ship and now I'm taking the Enterprise. And I thought, how are you going to take the Enterprise? I mean, even if you beam up, which you do, there are only like six of you and there are 400 people on the Enterprise. It seems unlikely that you're going to take over the Enterprise. But he's sure of himself.
I think maybe he's under the influence of the thing, right?
Because that's true.
Is where this is all going. And I think maybe that's what's really going on here. But the script, you know, it's not really clear. But yes, it does come across as being like, I will take your ship over. Hand it over to me now. Because as we know, if one ship shoots down another ship, by the transitive property, the captain of the shot down ship gets to be the captain of the other ship instead.
It's nautical tradition, yeah. Jason. That's how it works.
So, absolutely.
And the Klingons know that. And there they go. There's a lady Klingon in episode. And apparently, Memory Alpha tells me this is the only lady Klingon who ever speaks in the original series. The only lady Klingon. Also, unfortunately, Chekhov tries to sexually assault her, but we'll get to that later. Chekhov. Not my favorite part of this episode.
Again, under the influence of a glowy thing.
They say that as well, but I think I could have done without it.
Yeah.
Kirk gets punched, and then something so ridiculous. People do not see anything in this episode. So Kirk gets punched. The Klingon ship is going to blow up. It's spewing out radiation. That's why we can't, talk to anybody.
Right.
It's the Klingon's fault. So the Klingon Kang says, okay, Kirk, tell your ship to beam us up, but no funny business. And Kirk is like, of course. And tells them to beam him up. And then very clearly, he even turns his communicator towards the Klingons and presses a button that is apparently the engaging in funny business.
Yeah.
Spock, make sure to separate out the beaming, which I thought was clever, except the point where he shows the Klingons that he's doing it.
Yeah.
They don't care, but.
Yeah, he's really showing the audience that. But yeah, we do get that cool moment where the transporter only transports the Enterprise crew to the pads and leaves the Klingons in the transporter buffer, right? Like, this is one of those little bits of transporter lore that they've expanded upon over the years. But here it is, where they've filtered out the Klingons and kept them in the buffer, which leads, of course, later to Scotty saying, we should have just left him in there. Oblivion, that's what's best for them when he's under the influence of scotch and a pulsating, glowing entity.
And a claymore.
And a sword.
He does not know what's coming in his future, does he? Spoilers for Scotty in TNG.
Exactly.
And I skip over this part. So this is down on the planet before they beam up. Kang is like, okay, well, I'm going to kill somebody because I have to prove that I'm serious here. So who should I kill? And Chekhov is like, you animals, you killed my brother. And everyone's like, oh, I didn't know you had a brother, which comes up later. Mm-hmm. and Kang respects him and is going to kill him, but then he doesn't and everybody's fine and they beam up. Very weird. But clearly, yeah. Chekhov hates Klingons, and understandably, if in fact his brother had been killed by Klingons.
Right. But instead, this is, like, again, more evidence that everybody's already being messed with by this little glowy alien. Mm-hmm. That is actually the twist that I remember the most from this episode.
And that's a good, yeah, I like that twist.
Is that moment where, is it Sulu says he's an only child?
Yeah, he's like, what is wrong with him?
They killed his brother, of course. It's like,
only one problem with that, sir.
Yeah, yeah.
I also kind of thought, now there are a lot of people on the ship, but I kind of thought maybe Kirk would know that Chekhov didn't have any family. But as we know, it is kind of Star Trek lore that none of them know each other's family really well. So
right.
Everyone's always surprised by siblings.
Uh-huh. That's right.
And
nobody
continues
talks about their parents or their siblings.
Can't talk about our parents or siblings. It's all secretive. So we can, I guess, in the future, you don't talk about your family.
McCoy's got a daughter. Spock's got parents. Kirk's got a brother. We don't talk about it.
Nobody wants to hear about it. We are here to do a job, not to chit-chat. And I will not read your personnel file because that's somebody else's job.
I don't know. I mean, delegation. Can he read everybody's personnel file? And Chekhov's very serious. He's like, he's got the details. His brother.
True.
He's Piotr,
very convincing. I believed him. And I suppose the captain, it's the first officer who really should be doing that kind of crew thing. And Spock doesn't seem to care. So
No. But obviously Chekhov has talked about his family with Sulu. Mm-hmm. Sulu knows he's an only child, which
they spend a lot of time together.
Yeah, they spend time together, and they're pals, and you know, there's a level of remove there with Kirk and Spock, I think.
Yes, and you have to think. I mean, we see the most exciting parts of these fictional characters' lives, so you have to think there's a lot of just like flying between star systems and, you know, delivering grain to colonists,
lunch,
and moving scientists around,
eating food cubes in the cafeteria.
So they got a lot of time, and they're up there in those consoles, and you know, Kirk is not talking to them. He's, you know, signing things.
They're just sitting there pushing
Spock
buttons and probably chatting about family and other things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's how Sulu knows. Mm-hmm. And so Mara, I think that's Mara. Mara. She is Commander Kang's wife.
Yes.
But also his science officer.
Yes.
And she is under the impression that the Federation folks are going to kill them. And Kirk is like, we don't do that. We're not like you. and he says, we will beam over your fellow people from your ailing ship and then blow up your ship.
Right.
Seems very fair, helpful. I guess. And he says, we'll also give you a crew lounge and modify this food synthesizer to make Klingon food, which is nice.
Roctogeno for everyone.
Yeah. Blood wine.
Yeah, whatever you want.
Whatever. We have it.
You know, our synthesizers are struggling with turkey, but sure, we'll program some Klingon things in there. It'll be the
Klingon food blocks. Maybe that's why the Klingons are so cranky, because they're like, we'll make Klingon cuisine. And then they order gah, and it comes out as like cubes.
You know, this is 1968. So you know, the whole episode is very much a peace and love episode. That's the message.
Yes. War is bad, people.
And so it's an important point to have the we assumed you're monsters moment.
Yes.
Right. Because the whole idea is you don't know, you're being pitted against each other and you don't actually even know, and you just assume the worst about everyone. And that's a very TOS sentiment, especially. You see it a lot in the Vietnam era and the Cold War era. There are a lot of episodes that do stuff like that. So this is an interesting example of that she just assumes that they're going to be tortured, and that's what the Federation does. And they're like, no, we don't do that. So
that's not us. That's you.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, we don't really do that either. We just we like to beat people up. But
all right, okay, we do. But no, but that's not the point. Bit. No, maybe they don't.
Maybe just a little bit. It's we can't question their culture, Jason.
The Russians and love their children too. Right? That's what Stan right. tells me.
And he plays the lute. So we have to now we've got our Klingons on our. We've got 38 Klingons, I think, on the Enterprise. The rest of the Klingons have died, apparently, on their ship that's been blown up. And there's a malfunction of some sort, and bulkheads are closing in the Enterprise, so that 400 Enterprise folks, and the Enterprise has a complement of about 440, are locked behind these bulkheads that cannot be opened. And for whatever reason, Captain Kirk decides the Klingons are doing this, well, because of the
paranoia, glowing thing. Yeah.
Yep. He's like, oh, these Klingons. And then as he goes, I don't remember the exact order of this, but then the Enterprise just starts going crazy and going to Warp 9 to the edge of the galaxy for no particular reason. And I don't really understand why it's doing that in the show either. Like, what's the point of that? But
I always assumed that it's trying to, that the alien is trying to take its new little plaything away from where they could ever be rescued out into endless empty space where they can just grapple with each other for all eternity. I think that's the kind of that's my interpretation, is that there's the end game here is to endlessly torment these humans and Klingons by having them fight and not do it anywhere where there could be like a rescue mission. I think that's it.
I guess so. And so he runs down to that crew lounge and he's like, hey, Klingons, I give you Klingon food and this is how you repay me taking over my ship and making us fly to the end of the galaxy.
Yeah.
And the Klingons are like, we didn't do any of that. Somebody picks up something that then turns into a sword. Is my favorite sound effect, that bloop sound. I love that sound effect. And if you love it like me, you're in for a treat, because it happens a whole bunch immediately afterwards, because a lot of other things suddenly turn into swords, of a variety of swords. And thanks to paranoia, there's a little scuffle. Captain Kirk and the people he brought with him scurry out of the lounge. The Klingons are free, and he goes up to the bridge and basically says to Spock, those Klingons are turning stuff into swords.
Yeah.
And Spock is like, I
didn't know they had that power.
That's right. And if they had that power, why would they turn stuff into swords?
They turn phasers into swords instead of swords into phasers.
Exactly. And why would they give you the swords too? Kirk is like, I don't know what you're talking about,
Gotta think this through. Think this through. This is a setup. So they do get there. In Act 2, they got there, right? This is the other thing, is that this isn't one of those episodes where this all goes on and it's only at the end that they're like, oh, we're being manipulated. Like, Spock is like, this does not make sense. Right now.
This is banana pants, Captain.
Yeah.
And I read that as Spock is a little more resistant than other folks to this. And so because, you know, humans were awful. And the Klingons are the worst aspect of us. So in TOS, really, they're just, stand-ins for the Russians, who are not the worst aspects of Americans, but in American pop culture at the time, they were. I thought that was a good touch, because he has his wits about him until the end, or like the middle, when he almost punches out Scotty. But Scotty wasn't being very nice to him, so he got what he deserves.
Take that.
Yeah, so I will quickly sum up the plot, and then we can talk about any particular moments that stand out to you, because after all of this setup, they take a long time to get to the end, which is, so this alien wants them to fight, and it is every time someone gets murdered or injured, it will heal them so that they will never be able to die.
Yes.
Spock figures out, he scans the ship and figures out there's an extra thing there. They say, oh, it's probably an alien. And the computer just tells him, oh, it's an energy alien who seems to want to make you fight. And you're like, oh, we should have asked you earlier.
Yep, working. And, I know everything. Just ask me.
Exactly. I do enjoy the computer voice in this episode as well. And so Kirk is like, okay, well, we better go tell Kang this, and Kang doesn't believe him. And
right. And so it's sort of like in a trance at one point, which I think is also kind of scary, that like, how do you, once you figure it out, you need to get through to your enemy, and your enemy is not listening. And in fact, has been entranced by this creature to prevent.
Oh yes. But he has, they have rescued Mara from the advances of crazy Chekhov. And so she basically says to Kang, no, they're telling the truth. And Kang is like, oh, all right. And then they decide, in which might be the weirdest resolution to a TOS episode, although there are other episodes in season 3 that end oddly, that the best way to get rid of this alien is by laughing at it. So they laugh at it.
Yeah. It's almost as if, I mean, we skipped over a lot here, but like really, it's not a lot, because really what it is like, there's like, they go down here and then they come back over here and they get Mara and then they release Mara and they fight and then they stop fighting. And they, like, it kind of keeps going back and forth, but it is that thing, Scott, where at the end of many TOS episodes, everybody laughs.
Yes,
that's
literally,
that's like that... what this is like, hey, we can't just stop fighting. We need to do the part where we all laugh and pat each other on the back, which is, there is an amazing moment where Michael Ansara basically like punches William Shatner in the back like he's patting him on the back. It's so good. He's like, still a jerk, but ha, 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 we have to get along now. And then that is what, and then there's that shot of the little aliens like, I'm out of here.
Woo, I gotta go. Gone. I hate laughter.
I don't like your laughter. You're making fun of me. Stop making fun of me. I'm out of here.
Bullying is bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it ends. And I mean, I skipped a whole lot of stuff. There's some good stuff in there. But as you say, Jason, it's basically kind of repetitious.
It's kind of a runaround. It reminded me a little bit of like the old Doctor Who episodes a little bit, where there's just kind of some shenanigans where you're playing you're playing for time here. So there's, you know, things are broken, then they work again. The life support goes off, it goes back on. You know, they try to talk. Chekhov and Mara, it's really bad. But then Kirk tries to talk to her. Mm-hmm. And use her as like an olive branch. That part is interesting, but then, you know, and they do figure out, there's that moment where they figure out that it's feeding on their negative emotions essentially, and that is how they're going to have to solve this. They add the ticking time bomb of like the dilithium crystals are being eaten, so they have to solve this quickly. But yeah, in the end, it's not a lot in a, you know, in two or three acts of not a lot. And that's the thing that struck me about as I was watching it, is like, there are bursts of like really interesting stuff. And then there's some stuff that's really kind of like stretched out to get to that moment in the end, which is the message, right? Which is, we all need to get along. They higher powers want us to fight, but we should resist because they benefit when we fight. We should unite instead. And that's the message. That's your 60s TOS 1968 message here.
And I approve. Random Trek approves of that message, because they're manipulating you people. Be on the lookout.
Yeah. Well,
Trust no one.
The idea that the higher, you know, higher powers of society are benefiting from your struggle. And that they benefit from pitting different groups against each other, like I think that's a message that certainly still resonates, but certainly in 1968 would have resonated, and the height of 68, I mean, what a year that was, right? This is in the fall of 68, and that's, you know, Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy have been assassinated, and the Vietnam War is going on, and the presidential election, like all of that is going on.
A lot of stuff is happening.
This is, I think this first aired literally the week before the presidential election. So like, there's a lot going on here.
There's a lot of tension out there.
Yeah. And so this is the message, is enemies, maybe the enemies are not as bad as you think they are. And maybe somebody else is benefiting from your conflict, and that you should rethink it.
And I really like, I briefly mentioned that scene where Scotty comes onto the bridge and he's all like, we got to kill these Klingons. They're in engineering and they're going to get all of our secrets.
Whatever
and,
he says. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're going to betray the Federation, Kirk. We need to get down there. And Spock is basically like, hey, let's chill out, man. And, Scotty is like, get your Vulcan hands off me, and you half breed, and all of that. And one of my favorite moments of this episode is there's that tight shot of Spock, who says, "I have not always enjoyed serving with humans," and you can just see the cold rage behind his eyes as he then comes very close to beating Scotty to a bloody pulp. But Kirk stops him.
Yeah, because even Spock is affected by this this thing. Yeah. Other thing I want to mention about this episode, which again I think is okay, and for a third season Star Trek, that's actually pretty good.
This is a good third season.
Yeah, episode. I mean, there are some pacing problems, like we said, and I wish that it had been structured a little bit differently. But yeah, this is actually pretty good. Kang is great, great character. He's scary. Mm-hmm. He's intelligent, other than when he's got like the mind warp going on.
I love when he says that. He takes over the life support and he says over the intercom to the whole ship that they will die of suffocation in the icy cold of space.
Right.
I say, oh man, that's a good Klingon line.
And there's, I try to do that thing where I consider the period and say having Mara for 1968, they're trying to, I think, be a little progressive. But viewed from today, it's like, oh boy. Right. Of course, there's, yeah.
It's a
oh,
different
yeah.
time.
But
it's
she's his time. Wife. That's why she's around and all that. But yeah, it's true. Also, Michael Ansara, he's great. I was reminded of the fact that there's lots of problematic things about how the Klingons are cast in TOS, where it's not quite blackface. But it's kind of blackface.
It's a cousin.
And in this case with Michael Ansara, he was Lebanese Syrian, actually, like Danny Thomas. So he's of Middle Eastern origin. But they wanted all of the Klingons to have this kind of swarthy or very dark skin tone. And on the HD transfer, I mean, you could really see that. Everybody's been sort of slathered in makeup to make them look dark. And you can think about that and think, is there racial coding going on here? But at the same time, I feel like I always give it to TOS because it's kind of it was cheap. like Michael Ansara's got these crazy glued on eyebrows, to make him, I don't know, hairier.
Trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, they were just trying to make aliens, but they were limited with what they could do. And and the idea, I mean, let's say fundamentally saying, well, I know, we'll just cast a bunch of darker skinned people as the villains is like, maybe you shouldn't do that either. But at least with the movies and then into TNG, they actually spent some money to make the Klingons look more alien, and they've looked alien ever since. But regardless, Michael Ansara is great. Apparently he had played a lot of Native Americans too. This is the story of Hollywood, right? Where it was like, if you were not very, very clearly a white person, then you could play any other
any
part they wanted.
Non-white person. Yes. You're fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, so anyway, but he's great. I just love his voice, and they brought him back. He was in DS9 and Voyager episodes, as Kang too, which is fun.
Is great. Yeah. And those episodes are great as well. Mm-hmm. And, this makes me think, as you were talking, I just watched last night a Deep Space Nine episode, which is possibly one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek ever. It is not subtle, but it is really good. Far Beyond the Stars, where Sisko imagines, the prophets imagine him as a sci-fi writer in the 1950s, dealing with racism and all that stuff. So, very good episode. But the Star Trek in 1968 could not do that episode, but they came close. They tried their best. Yeah. And yeah, Kang is a great character, and it's fun to see him come back later in Deep Space Nine and try to fight the albino in that episode with Dax.
Yep.
I think he comes back with another episode too, but I don't remember.
Yeah, it's in the flashback episode, which is the Sulu episode of Voyager.
Yes.
He's in that.
Oh, and he's in the Sword of Kaelas as well.
Mm, there you go.
Making a lot of things. And he, Michael Ansara, was married to
Barbara Eden.
I Dream of Jeannie. Yes, yeah. Barbara Eden. I Dream of Jeannie.
Yeah.
Who
yeah.
knew? The things that you find out yeah. when but he's people.
For TOS fans, like, this is the great triumvirate of Klingon
mm-hmm.
opposition, right? Is Kang, Kor, and Koloth. Those are the big three. And they come back in that DS9 episode, right?
Where all three of them do come
here
back.
Here they are. Those are those guys. Because
you remember these Klingons?
Because the producers of, I mean, it's really Ron Moore, I think. Ron Moore was a gigantic TOS fan. And so mm-hmm. on Deep Space Nine, they're like, yeah, let's do all the TOS references. They were far enough along that they could. I think TNG was a little more afraid to tread too heavily on the ground, unlike modern Star Trek, which is like, give me all those references, baby. I think TNG was like, easy now.
We're a new thing.
And DS9 was like, yeah, let's bring back the Klingons. We don't care. We love it. And it's great because they are great. Nobody, let's put it this way. Everybody still remembers the Klingon commanders. And what they don't remember is a little glowy, spinny alien spirograph thing. There's nobody, everybody remembers that guy. Also, is this guy related to Red Jack? That's another question that I had.
Well, my other question is, you, crew of the Enterprise, have encountered many energy beings who mm-hmm. kind of want to do the same exact thing. So you would think, now we can just wave this away by saying the energy being is clouding their mind, so they're not at their best.
Yes.
But you feel like they could have guessed this a little sooner that it was happening. To your point, Jason, they do figure it out pretty quickly. But I feel like it would have been a lot sooner.
And in this episode, what they don't do is they don't have like a solution like in some TOS episodes where there's a thing you can get injected with or a thing that mm-hmm. you go through, like, you know, you get
the
spores
polarity or something.
Yeah, you get spores or you get light or you get put in a thing and we radiate you or there's a mind meld or like there are so many TOS episodes where like everybody's acting weird and then there's a solution to it. That doesn't happen in this episode, which I wonder if Jerome Bixby, who wrote it, I wonder if that was the argument, was sort of like, no, we need to show them rising above it. This is not a science fictional solution here. This is we need to rise above it as rational beings solution. And that's what they do. And that is kind of fun because they could have a science fictional answer to this and they don't. That would be, if I was doing my script notes through time travel to 1968, that would be one of the things I would probably say is, wouldn't it be nice to say, Spock, isn't there some way we can like a cure for this? And Spock says that there's no cure for this other than our own reason, something like that, right?
Because there's no cure for aggression.
Captain. Yeah. It's been with us for the entire histories of our races. Mm-hmm. We must overcome it ourselves, right? Because that's right. The whole
Even
message, man.
Vulcans have attempted to master it. Sometimes it gets the better of us.
It does. Yeah. So
it's true.
Yeah. But again, season 3, Star Trek, you're like, oh, oh no, is it going to be Mumenschantz? Is there going to be mimes and dancing? And no, there's a flitty
no
alien
dancing.
Guy and there's a very charismatic
a bendy,
Klingon and swords.
Bendy swords.
Yeah.
Which I suppose, you know, actual swords do bend, but not as much as the fake swords they use in this episode of Star Trek.
And, you know, I don't love season 3 of Star Trek, but I do feel like this one does what Star Trek was sort of sold to be, which is swashbuckling adventure, literally swashbuckling adventure. And
many buckles are swashed in this episode.
And a message, right? Like a meaning of like, oh, here, but think mm-hmm. about the big picture, man. And like, I don't think this episode maybe does any of that as elegantly as some of Star Trek's best episodes from this period, but it does it, right? Like a kid sitting down on November 1st, 1968 and watching this episode would be entertained and their parents sitting down would be like, oh, I see. Yes, that is a good message that we have to rise above this. And like,
layers
that's
upon
what
layers.
It's supposed to be. That is what mm-hmm. Star Trek's supposed to be.
And apparently reading These Are the Voyages, you find out that One of the things that Star Trek directors struggled with, and probably still struggle with, I don't know, is shooting these things on time and under budget.
Oh, yeah. In 5 days or whatever it was, 6 days.
Yeah, because they didn't have a lot of time, to be honest. And they didn't have a lot of budget, as you pointed out, Jason. So they I've said this before on this podcast, but before I started this podcast, I never really thought of television making as a thing. I just, I just see the completed unit and consume it, but never think about the work that it takes to get there. So reading These Are the Voyages, which is a great series of books that breaks down every single episode of Star Trek, the original series, and tells you all the production notes and all kinds of details. And if you're not totally nerding out about that idea, don't read that book because you will be completely bored by it. But
they literally would not rehire directors if they took too long.
Yes. Time is money, literally. Yeah. And if it takes too long, it's like, then we can't film this other episode. Mm-hmm. So you got to do it quickly. So this episode, under time, they took 5.5 days, apparently, to shoot this episode. So good job to Martin Chomsky, who probably shot more than one episode of Star Trek because he did it so quickly.
Martin Chomsky, or maybe he didn't. Did, oh, yes, he did. Indeed.
And The Children Shall Lead and All Our Yesterdays.
Right, which is the next to last episode. So they brought him back, basically. Mm-hmm. And that was a good sign. That meant that you were on time and under budget, because otherwise they wouldn't. And then he directed Roots.
Oh, did he?
And he has, and for those asking, those like me who have a communication degree,
oh,
yes, he is related to Noam Chomsky. He's his cousin.
Oh, look at that. And he lived to 92.
He did.
Good Lord. Good for him.
Good
job. And he has 4 Emmys.
Yeah. Noam Chomsky is still alive, 94, but never directed an episode of Star Trek.
0 Emmys, I assume.
Yeah, Noam Chomsky. What have you done with your life, Noam Chomsky?
What are you doing? More like Noam Chomsky.
Oh,
I'm sure he's never heard that before.
No, because people respect him for his long legacy of public intellectualism in fields such as social criticism and yeah. Anyway, yes, take that, Chomsky. Take that back to MIT.
That's right.
Whatever.
You get no respect on this podcast.
No, because your cousin Marvin, that's
a life
Chomsky
to emulate.
To mm-hmm.
On time and under budget. Chomsky, come on.
What are we even doing here anymore? I don't even know, Scott.
I don't know. Well, what we're going to do is thank Mr. Jason Snell for joining me to talk about, as requested. Now, Jason, are going to reveal a secret that I've revealed on this episode, not this episode, but on this podcast before. It is random, but sometimes I say to my guest, because they are basically donating their time to me, if you have a particular series that you enjoy, we could limit it to that. And Jason requested an original series episode. And so you got this one. So there you go.
Yeah. And then you give me a third season episode and I go, what are you doing here? But again, this was actually a perfectly fine one. You and I have watched some very odd TOS episodes.
Oh, yes.
This is not one of them. This is, I would, mm-hmm. I don't have, unlike some of our listeners, I'm sure,
who
have assembled a master list of rankings of all the TOS episodes, or perhaps all Star Trek episodes ever. I'm just guessing here. This is probably in the middle for me, right? I think this is a...
Of all Star Trek episodes or
of
original
TOS.
Series? Okay.
Of TOS. It feels like, right? Because there are the good episodes and there are the bad episodes. And then there is the big middle. And this, like I said, swashbuckling with a message. It is in some ways an archetypal Star Trek. I mean, in fact, I had to laugh on Memory Alpha. It describes this episode and says, this episode bears many similarities to other episodes. And I said, yes, it does.
Yes.
It's got the people's minds are being clouded and there's an energy being. And there's like, yes, it is like a lot of Star Trek episodes. But it's fine. It's perfectly fine. I'm relieved that it's a perfectly fine TOS episode. Although maybe next time I'm on, I'll change it up and we'll do TNG, because I love TNG too.
What? And
we started with that, but like, it's hard for me to resist talking to my pal Scott about TOS because get a chance to revisit those TOS episodes that often.
I do love TOS. And this TOS episode doesn't suffer. Like, there are I think that you can be a good Star Trek episode, and I enjoy those the most. You can be a really bad Star Trek episode, and those are enjoyable because they're so bad.
Yeah.
And then there's the boring middle ones.
Yeah.
Where you're like, it's non-offensive, but so I think this isn't boring. So it's even it's pushed onto the better side of the middle for me. My faint praise for this episode. It's not boring.
It's not boring. Well, no, I mean that is a big one. Is my one of my favorite podcasts is The Flophouse, and they watch a bad movie every week, and they've been doing it for like 400 episodes. A very long time they've been doing that podcast. And one of the things that I think that they've learned over time is that the greatest sin is not being bad. The greatest sin is being boring.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, because then you're watching it and you're like, what am I even doing here? You start to question all your life choices. And I didn't think of that with Day of the Dove. I'm like, look, there's a flitty thing and they're fighting with swords and they're it's perfectly entertaining.
And talking to you, Jason, is more than perfectly entertaining. It is practically perfect in every way.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure as always.